Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So I'm going to talk here about the four cardinal virtues this evening, and a fair bit of what I have to say is going to be philosophical. And at times a little dense, but I promise I'm going to end with a story by J.R.R. Tolkien. And if you fall asleep before that, ask someone next to you to poke you when I start retelling. Now, may I ask, how many of you have heard of the cardinal virtues before this evening? Okay, how many of you could name all four of them? Oh, all right. I see you in the back. Okay, good. So I'm going to give you an overview of all four virtues. Then I'm going to talk about a couple striking features of them, two especially that I'm most interested in, and then I'll turn a little bit to Tolkien at the end. Okay, so what makes a person good? This question confronts us immediately with the beating heart of the moral life, its dark mysteries and terrifying joys. I suppose my title this evening suggests an answer that's very old. The cardinal virtues make us live well. They're not the only things we need to live well. The three theological virtues, faith, hope, and love, that I'm not going to talk about this evening, have to be added to the cardinal virtues if we're going to become saints. And not becoming a saint, of course, is the only real tragedy in life. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me start from the beginning. Cardinal is from the Latin word cardinalis. It means principal, chief, or essential, like the cardinal points of a compass, north, south, east, and west. This is a figurative use based on the word cardo, which just means hinge, as in a door hinge. So we might say the cardinal virtues are the hinges on which our life turns. The word virtue, on the other hand, comes from the Latin word virtus, meaning excellence. It was used by the Roman Cicero to translate the older Greek word arete, which also means excellence. And it's to the Greeks that we owe the original development of the tradition of the virtues. Plato, that most astonishing of ancient thinkers, integrated all the virtues, especially the cardinal virtues, into the fabric of his many discussions of the moral life, most importantly in the Republic. How many of you have read the Republic? Okay, well, you should read the Confessions first, but then after that, the Republic. In the Republic, the cardinal virtues structure that dialogue, and it's one of the great masterpieces of the Western canon. Cicero appropriated Plato's emphasis on those four virtues, and his great moral treatise called De Officiis, on duties, is organized around them. Now, this pagan tradition was appropriated almost immediately by the Christian fathers, and even perhaps by divine scripture itself centuries earlier. The Book of Wisdom, for example, was written in Greek, probably a generation or two before Christ, by someone clearly well-versed in the Greek and Roman philosophical tradition. Chapter 8, verse 7 says, "If anyone loves righteousness, wisdom's labors are virtues, for she teaches," and here are the four virtues, "temperance and prudence, justice and courage." The emphasis on virtue in the ancient world was brought to a crescendo in the High Middle Ages by the thinker most dear to the heart of the Thomistic Institute, Thomas Aquinas. He organized the whole second part of his Summa Theologiae, his largest, most well-known, most extensive work, around the four cardinal virtues and the three theological virtues. And even though the language of virtue has declined a little bit, I think for us in our own age, they nevertheless remain at the heart of our own moral discourse. I think courage and justice most especially, temperance and prudence not quite as much, but they're still there. Plato knew well, and the tradition that followed him also, that to speak of the virtues as special forms of human excellence requires us first to think about human nature. The virtues are names we give to perfections of ourselves. Plato thought that all of us have within ourselves, in our soul, he would say, and the Christian tradition follows him in this, though it works just as well to speak of our character or our inner life or our psychology. It's a discipline that comes from the Greek word for soul, psuche. All of us, thinks Plato, hold within ourselves something, generally speaking, three parts. There's a part of ourself that thinks, that's rational, that's reflective. There's a part that's spirited, emotional. And there's a desiring part, an appetitive part. Plato arranged the cardinal virtues to perfect those parts of ourselves. And St. Thomas does likewise. For him, reason, the part of ourself that's reflective, is broken into two parts, our intellect and our will. And for St. Thomas, too, we have a part that's emotional, that's spirited. He calls it the irascible power. And we have a part that desires, that's appetitive. So there are four kind of elements of ourselves. And the four cardinal virtues line up with those. Okay, I'm going to slow down and work through each one of these four a little bit, according to St. Thomas. Let's start with prudence. This is sometimes called practical wisdom. St. Thomas distinguishes between intellectual virtues and moral virtues. Intellectual virtues are things that perfect our ability to know things. Moral virtues perfect our ability to desire in certain ways. Prudence is an intellectual virtue. It means to know what to do here and now in order to achieve what's most important for us, our happiness, our fulfillment. If you're prudent, you know what to do right in the moment. Our life, I think, might be best described as one long striving for deep happiness. And the prudent person knows what to do in order to move in that direction. Here's two kind of important features of prudence. First, for St. Thomas, there's no rule book that can tell you what to do. The Ten Commandments should always be obeyed, but how to interpret them, whether this particular killing counts as a murder, or whether this particular false statement counts as a lie, all those difficult, peculiar situations that all of us face each day, hopefully not the murder one, but maybe the lying one, face each day, only prudence makes it possible for us to know what to do. So prudence is the intellectual virtue that makes it possible for you to make a good choice, because you can see what the right choice is for you. Now here's a second striking feature. So there's no rules, no rule book. You have to have a kind of inner life to yourself, an inner knowledge. Here's a second feature. Prudence helps us know the means to happiness, and consequently the means to every good end. Craftiness, for St. Thomas, is a kind of counterfeit prudence. Craftiness helps us identify the means to an end, kind of like prudence. But the crafty person doesn't care about the means themselves and how those might fit into your larger life. It only cares about achieving this particular end here and now. It doesn't see the big picture. So the crafty person lives a small life, a life focused on just this particular good thing. But if you're prudent, you not only see everything before you, but you can see the larger shape of things, your own life, but also the lives of those around you. It's almost as if you can see your life close up, but you can also see the whole stretched out all around and into the future. Now, I'm reminded here of a wonderful story, wonderful in certain respects, that I like from the 1970s by Ursula Le Guin. The ones who walk away from Omelas. I wonder if you're nodding your head. At least one person's maybe heard of it, maybe read it before. It's a remarkable story. In that story, a town is perfectly happy. Its residents, the warmest of friends. Its harvests, abundant. There is a lot of alligator meat on the table. Its scholars wise, its skies clear, on the single condition that one child is kept as a miserable and half-starved prisoner deep in the basement of a beautiful public building. Those who stay in the town, those who do not walk away, are crafty for St. Thomas. They'll tolerate any means necessary for some particular good thing that they desire. So, to be prudent is to know at the very moment what you should do within the context of a whole life. To be just, the second cardinal virtue, is to will to do, to want to do, the thing that prudence shows us. Our will for Aquinas is a special form of desire. The kind of desire that's sparked by knowable things, by the things we know by means of our intellect, our mind. In St. Thomas's precise language, here's St. Thomas, justice is a habit whereby a man renders to each one his due by a constant and perpetual will. How striking here that we find that the most important excellence of the human power to choose, the living flame of our soul, in a sense, consists in a certain orientation outside of ourself, towards others. It'd be difficult, I think, to find a more resounding affirmation of Aristotle's old claim, those of you who might know his Politics and his Ethics, that we're by nature social animals. Our lives, oriented as they are to happiness, are likewise ordered towards one another. Our happiness is most properly shared, something that happens with others, ordered and arranged like an enormous and beautiful living organism. Now, I could speak about this in another way by using the vocabulary of the common good. My happiness, your happiness, the happiness of all of us is a common good. That is, it's something shareable and shared between us. Think, for example, of the other things we know, like mathematics, astronomy, politics, gardening, artistic accomplishments, the statistics coming at us hard and fast each maddening month of March. Those are common goods, shareable, shared, knowledge that depends on a common life together. Each of us loses nothing by giving it to another. Indeed, we deepen our own possession of a common good in the very act of giving it away. Material things are not like that. If I eat an apple, you don't get to eat it too. And if I share it with you, it's only by lessening what I myself get to swallow. So it makes sense, I think, that St. Thomas would say some unusual things about material goods while discussing justice. Things that are not the common good, the thing that makes us happy, but a kind of means to it. Here's something unusual, he says. For example, the reason of human beings, not nature, introduce private property. By the law of nature, natural law, even though each of us is individually permitted to manage and dispense external things, this is principally for reasons of convenience, because material goods are better cared for when a particular person is responsible for them. And things are more orderly when managed this way, more peaceful. But even though we should all possess, as managers, our individual material goods, here's St. Thomas, we should not possess external goods as our own, but as common possessions, in such a way that we readily share the goods when others are in need. Some of you might have heard of the Catholic social thought phrase, the universal destination of goods. How many of you have heard that phrase? A few, okay. The universal destination of goods. That's a theological term for the same thing that I just described from St. Thomas. One of its great sources in the tradition, its foundations, is this passage and passages near it in Aquinas' work. It's a remarkable implications that come from this. For example, he says, natural law requires that superfluous things in your possession be used for the sustenance of the poor. And even more strikingly, this is quite striking, if the necessity, here I'm quoting from Thomas again, if the necessity is so pressing and clear that one has an immediate need of things at hand, for example, when personal danger threatens, and there's no other way to avoid it, then one may lawfully alleviate one's necessity with the goods of another, whether one takes them openly or secretly. And this does not have the character of theft or robbery. This sometimes reminds me of a great 19th century novel, Les Miserables. How many of you have read that? And that's a long one, I'm afraid, although it has lots of wonderful film adaptations and, of course, the great musical, Broadway musical. At the center of that story, a vast kind of epic novel, is a character named Jean Valjean. Poor, he's starving. At the beginning of the story, he takes a loaf of bread from a bakery to feed his family. And he's sent as a result to prison, the start of a long novel about morality and poverty in Napoleonic France. For St. Thomas, I can't help but think the taking of that bread would have been justified, and it would not have counted as an act of theft, because material things are always in the service of our shared life together. And if our individual possession of those material things gets in the way of that common life, then our right to keep them can fall away. Prudence and justice, we might say, the pinnacle of the moral life, they perfect our highest faculties, our reason and our will. But fortitude and temperance, the third and fourth cardinal virtues, they're necessary too, virtues that shape the desiring, the appetitive part of our souls. These virtues protect us from things that might frustrate our real pursuit of happiness. Fortitude, for example, or courage, makes it possible for us to respond correctly, rightly, to obstacles put in the way of our happiness. I suppose it's usual today, I do this myself, especially in a place of long-standing peace, like the United States, so many of us have enjoyed for so long, we should speak of bravery in many contexts, most of which don't have much to do with death. I can be brave when I get stuck by a needle at the doctor's office. I can be brave when I speak in public. I can be brave when I take my medicine. I can be brave when I do anything that it's right to do, even if it's a little difficult. There's something I think right about this. Courage is the virtue that makes it so that I persevere. I keep going, even in the face of the things that are difficult. But for St. Thomas, courage is most of all about perseverance in the face of death. It's only, and here's a kind of implication, it's only really when you have identified something that you would die for, something you would not do, even if threatened with death, or something that you would do, even if it meant the loss of your life, only then do you really know what matters most in your heart. It's part of leaving childhood behind that each of us comes to see which things we would die for. Or perhaps for some of us, we come to see that there's nothing for which we would die, that being alive is what we care about most. So naturally, courage is about fear, that special form of appetite or desire that consists in wanting that something should not happen. And for St. Thomas, fortitude is the virtue that shapes our fears so that they do not prevent us from seeing, loving, choosing what's really good. Fortitude, for example, is the special virtue of the martyrs. Fortitude also shapes the fierce part of ourselves that responds to danger. Sometimes when we must fight, we're afraid. And sometimes even at the same time, we're angry. And fortitude's about anger. St. Thomas says, some have thought that the perfect soul would never be angry. But that's not the right way to think about the moral life. For virtuous persons, he says, or St. Thomas again, should employ both anger and the other passions of the soul according to reason. Christ in the temple, when he overturned the tables of the money changers, was angry with a righteous anger. And so too, we should be angry when we must fight for the good. If fortitude helps us with what scares us, temperance, the last of the cardinal virtues, helps us with what pleases us. Temperance, we might say, makes us excellent pleasure experiencers. As St. Thomas says, temperance denotes a kind of moderation and is chiefly concerned with those passions that tend towards sensible goods, namely desire and pleasure, and consequently with the sorrow that arises from the absence of those pleasures. Like fortitude, temperance is an expansive virtue. And so it's about all sorts of desires, like the desire to watch March Madness instead of attending a remarkable philosophy lecture, or the desire to see the new Terrence Malick movie, a desire that all of you should have. And if you don't know who Terrence Malick is, you should look him up after you leave this evening. But just as fortitude's most of all about the fear of death, so temperance is most of all about the pleasures of food, drink, and sex. Those deepest, most primordial of human pleasures. The ones, says St. Thomas, that are most natural to our animal selves. The temperate person can persevere in the pursuit of what is best, even in the face of the seductions of the senses, and especially the sense of touch. So fasting and abstinence are related to prudence. I just learned, by the way, that there's a monster that eats you if you eat meat on Fridays in Louisiana. I didn't know about that, but it's true. I'd like to bring him up with me to Rhode Island, actually. Fasting and abstinence are related to prudence, since those practices shape the way that desires affect our choices. We want to become people who, when we miss a meal, or our morning coffee, or an expected, hoped-for embrace, nevertheless maintain our composure, our goodness. Eating late, or poorly, or missing coffee shouldn't throw us into a bad mood. It shouldn't make it so that we're bad. Being hungry and thirsty, we don't want that to frustrate our ability to be good. Now, sometimes it might seem that the courageous person is the fearless person, but nothing could be further from the mind of St. Thomas. The courageous person's not fearless. Such a person would just be reckless. Instead, the courageous person fears what ought to be feared and perseveres regardless, even in the face of fear. Just so, the temperate person isn't insensible to the delights of the senses, as if being truly virtuous meant not caring about the delights of the earth. The temperate person really sees the goodness of creation, really feels sensible pleasures, and yet doesn't let the desire for those things distract from what must be done here and now. If I could hazard a more general thought here, only the one who really knows and loves, properly speaking, food, drink, and sex can be temperate, just as only the one who really knows and fears death can be brave. The achievement of virtue, then, depends on genuine understanding, insight into all the goodness of the created world. So prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance. These four virtues, the cardinal virtues, the principal excellences of the human moral life, they're each mysterious in their depths and wonders. And I've only just hinted at yet each a little bit in this summary of some of St. Thomas's reflections. But it's enough, I hope, to give you at least a good introduction. And now I want to talk about two important implications before I turn to Tolkien. So first implication. The cardinal virtues aren't like things I can acquire and add to my possession of good things, like other things are. We use nouns to refer to the virtues, as if they themselves were particular things. Courage is a noun. Temperance is a noun. But this is misleading. The virtues describe ways of being. They're in some ways better referred to, grammatically speaking, by means of adjectives or adverbs. Properly speaking, I don't have prudence. I am prudent. That's the adjective. Or I act prudently. That's the adverb. To acquire the cardinal virtues, there's the noun again, but it's actually to become a certain kind of person. I'd like to say we become the cardinal virtues. The cardinal virtues just are, deep down, a way of describing a morally healthy and mature human being. To fail to progress in the cardinal virtues is to fail to grow. It's to be a kind of stunted or even deformed, malnourished, and so unable to achieve what we were designed for. Now, how does one grow in this way? The tradition of the virtues has a striking answer to this question. We grow in virtue by acting virtuously. That sounds a little paradoxical. Like learning other skills, like playing music or sports, we learn morality by practicing being moral. And since we don't start off knowing what that looks like or how to do it, we grow in virtue by imitating other virtuous people. The act of imitation introduces us to the moral life and eventually makes it possible for us to be a model in turn for others. Indeed, human beings naturally imitate, and young children automatically imitate those around them, thereby hopefully taking their first steps on the road to virtue, or unfortunately possibly to vice, depending on their playmates and their caretakers. St. Thomas doesn't deny that each of us has within ourselves the special voice of natural law, but he does agree with Aristotle that this voice, the voice of conscience, only awakens in the company of others, for we learn by and through imitation. Now, I think this idea helps make sense of something Pope Benedict XVI once said. He said, "Art and the saints are the greatest apologists for the faith." Each of us needs moral exemplars, people both real and fictional, who show us what is possible and desirable, who draw us upwards into the moral life. How can I aspire to lifelong married monogamy if I do not have before me examples of joy-filled monogamous couples? So the first implication of the cardinal virtues is that we don't acquire them the way we acquire other ordinary things. And this has enormous implications for human life, including, of course, the few brief and precious years spent at colleges. The second implication has likewise some important consequences. St. Thomas again argues that the cardinal virtues are unified in a deep sense. You can't have one without the others. And so in some sense, to grow in courage is also to grow in justice and temperance and prudence. There's no such thing for St. Thomas as being forced, for example, to choose between the just thing and the prudent thing, or the courageous thing. The virtues never conflict with one another. Now, this is not always a very popular position. It seems kind of strict, I suppose, as if it meant that were someone to act badly in one way, they'd have no virtue at all. There's an argument somewhat like this that was developed in the 20th century by the Catholic philosopher Peter Geech in the 1970s. May I ask how many of you have heard of Peter Geech? So how about Elizabeth Anscombe? Okay, Peter Geech was her husband. Two remarkable Catholic British philosophers in the 20th century. He published this, the lectures he gave in the 1970s, he published a little bit later in a thin book called The Virtues, which I recommend to all of you. Along with the essays, by the way, of Joseph Pieper, the German Catholic philosopher on the virtues, wrote a great book called The Four Cardinal Virtues, published in the 1950s. And shortly after, a book called Faith, Hope, and Love on the Theological Virtues. These two authors are a great introduction to the theme that I'm speaking to you on tonight, and they both complement one another and in interesting places conflict a little bit with one another, such as here regarding the unity of the virtues. St. Thomas taught, and Joseph Pieper defends his position, that each human life is ordered towards a final end. And prudence is the virtue that helps us know how to achieve it. And the moral virtues, justice, courage, temperance, they all together express an orientation towards this end, a desire for it. So that the four cardinal virtues are unified because they're all ordered towards the same end, our true happiness. And so to lack one means simply that we aren't ordered towards that end after all. We're not as much as we thought we were. Now, Peter Geech thought this argument didn't work, and even more, that it had rather grim consequences.
If this argument were valid, he said, it would mean that if a man is manifestly affected with one vice, then any virtue that he may seem to have along with his vice is only spurious. And really, he's vicious in this respect too, and not entitled to the admiration that his virtue seems to call for. But this doesn't seem to match up to our experience, he argued. In all the world over, a man may be very laudable in some respects, and yet vicious in others. And so we might say, we have evidence for thinking the virtues are not unified. Can't I be courageous and yet not particularly just? Brave but not always prudent. I side here with Pieper and St. Thomas and against Geech. And I think there's a way to make sense of Geech's everyday evidence and still keep the unity of the virtues. I opened a few minutes ago with a reference to faith, hope, and love, the three theological virtues, without which we can't achieve true happiness and peace. The primary purpose of those three virtues for St. Thomas is to reorient us to a new supernatural end. Faith is the vision of that end, hope the conviction that we might achieve it, charity the desire of our will for its achievement. The theological virtues reorient us in a deep sense so that before what we aimed at was only a natural good, and now we aim at union with God. So what are we to make of the cardinal virtues before we're reoriented towards God? Can't we admire the virtuous pagan, for example, even if that pagan lacks the grace to know and love God? It seems to me that this question is the same one Geech was thinking about, though in a different context. Can't we admire the apparent courage of the vicious man who lives the life of a glutton? Surely we do not want to say that because everything is not fully in line with our ultimate end, nothing of virtue remains to a person. So I think the right way to think about this is to remember that we can praise many character traits that are not full virtues, in the sense described by Aquinas. The man who seeks noble but earthly ends, such as the honor of his country, and neither knows nor cares for any God in the heavens, lacks the theological virtues. But he might possess the cardinal virtues in the following sense. He's become the kind of person who could more easily be completed by the theological virtues, were he to accept them when offered. Contrast such a man with the vicious man who lives only for himself and so is not prepared in any real sense to be completed by the theological virtues. It seems to me that this sort of thing happens all the time. It's one thing to have some good things, but not enough or not quite in the right way. And it's another thing to lack those good things entirely, or even to possess what's contrary to them. If I'm learning to play the piano, I might have many different skills that prepare me for good playing, even if they don't yet mean I can play the piano. And this is different from having bad habits that can't lead to good piano playing and would frustrate any attempt to learn. So, I think, of course, we can admire the man who does many good things, even though he's vicious in other ways. For the good things really are good. And even though we cannot say that he possesses full prudence and justice and courage and temperance, we can say that he possesses traits that are good in themselves, that prepare the ground, so to speak, that are worth imitating, just insofar as it would be possible for them to be taken up into a genuinely good life. The cardinal virtues of the man of faith, hope, and love are different and better and more perfect than the cardinal virtues of the good pagan. And the cardinal virtues of the good pagan are different, better, more perfect. What should we call them? Perhaps elements of the cardinal virtues of the vicious man. Now, let me hazard one more thought here. In the end, I think it would take a good deal of reflection to think about what this might mean. I think the virtuous person, the prudent, just, courageous, and temperate person, is the way they are because they're doing a certain sort of thing. The cardinal virtues are, altogether, simply different ways of considering a dynamic, full activity, the activity of a good life. The virtues are different ways of describing something deep and something mysterious, that this particular person is moving ever closer to true fulfillment and true perfection. Now, I hope at least to have helped you think more deeply about the tradition of the virtues, to see some of its beauty, as well as some of its complexity. Here now is my promised story from Tolkien. I'm going to retell, much too briefly, I'm afraid, the last story he published at the end of his life, long after his fame had spread across the world for The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. It's a tale tinged with melancholy, but also with love and with the deep things of which the virtues speak. It's entitled Smith of Wootton Major. And have any of you read this story? Yeah, it's quite a powerful story. It's not long. It's published in 1967. Tolkien was 75, just 6 years before his death. The story goes like this. There once was a village close by the woods called Wootton Major, known for its town hall, where regular feasts and other gatherings were held, the greatest of which was the week-long winter feast. Every 24 years, this feast concluded with the 24 feast, to which only 24 children were invited, and for which the master cook was required to make a great cake. By the excellence or otherwise of this, his name was chiefly remembered, for a master cook seldom, if ever, lasted long enough in office to make a second great cake. One day, the reigning master cook departed, suddenly, and returned after a while with Alf, a boyish-looking outsider, whom the cook brought back as his apprentice. Shortly afterwards, the master cook left without warning, never to return. And the village appointed Noakes, a boorish and lazy man, who nevertheless had some experience with cookery, as the new master cook. Young Alf, being evidently too inexperienced and young to succeed the old master. By and by, the next 24 feasts drew near, and Noakes, whose only successes depended on the knowledge and skill of the apprentice Alf, found himself at a loss, unprepared and uninspired. But he found in an old dusty box a single small star, black-looking, as if it was made of silver, but was tarnished. "That's funny," Noakes said as he held it up to the light. "No, it isn't," said Alf, speaking in a tone new to Noakes. "It is fae," said Alf. "It comes from fairy." Noakes laughed again, snickering at the seriousness with which Alf took such childishness, and suggested they bake the star into the cake for one of the children to find. "It'll make them laugh," he says. "I don't think it will, master," says Alf. "But it's the right thing to do, quite right." But none of the children found the star at the feast. Instead, a little boy, Smith, swallowed it. And from then on, some of its light passed into his eyes, and its music into his voice, and he became well known for his beauty, both in his person and in his workmanship. For he had become the most skillful smith for many miles, and lived a quiet life with his wife Nell, and his daughter Nan, and son Ned. From time to time, he would wander alone into the land of faery, though he remained a learner and a wanderer, not a warrior. But he was as safe as a mortal can be in that perilous country, and because of the star that shone on his forehead, the lesser evils avoided him, and from the greater evils he was protected. Sometimes his journeys were long, and he would see things both beautiful and terrible. Once he stood beside the sea of windless storm, while elven mariners, tall and terrifying, marched past him. Another time he was hunted by the wind for disturbing the quiet of a vast frozen lake. But when he was almost 60 years old, he found himself before the Queen of Faery, whom he recognized from a woodland dance many years before. They spoke long together, for the most part without words, and he learned many things in her thought, some of which gave him joy, and others filled him with grief. This time he knew that the future led back to bereavement, as well as peace. As he leaves Faerie, after meeting the queen, he meets Alf, now himself the master cook and no longer the apprentice, who reveals himself to Smith as the king of Faerie. And at the king's prompting, Smith gives up his star, for it must now pass to another child at the upcoming 24 feast. And he returns home, full of great weariness and bereavement. And so the star comes to Noak's grandson, as it turns out, who did not much take after his old grandfather. Smith never traveled to Faerie again, but instead helped teach his son Ned what he could, and enjoyed with delight, as well as rue, the quiet evening of his life. Now, like the story Leaf by Niggle, which perhaps some of you have also read, conceived and published in the early 1940s, while Tolkien was writing The Lord of the Rings, Smith of Utenmajor is straightforward, even simple, on its surface, but dark and mysterious in its depths. I don't wish to mar this story too much with overinterpretation this evening, and I'd like it best, honestly, if this little shortened retelling sent you back to read the original. But let me conclude with just a few brief comments on Tolkien's farewell to Fairyland. In this story, we see the two great marks of the cardinal virtues. We see, for example, the connection between master and apprentice, and that virtue is learned through imitation, with sometimes some confusion regarding who counts as the master and who the apprentice. We also see that the virtues are unified for Tolkien as they are for St. Thomas. For while a person might have some smaller talents here and there and still not be virtuous, the truly virtuous person, when cast into the fire of tribulation, preserves what is most precious. And so Smith does not lie to the Faerie King when given a chance, hoping to keep the star for himself. More generally, each of the four cardinal virtues are present here in its own way. Temperance is a story about cakes, after all. Fortitude, in little ways, but also in great ones, when Smith must fear for his life in Fairyland. Justice, Tolkien himself said of the story that the love of Faerie is the love of love, a relationship towards all things, animate and inanimate, which includes love and respect, and removes or modifies the spirit of possession and domination. And finally, prudence, living wisdom, or the wisdom to live well. Smith ends by giving up the star and by choosing wisely and well who should receive it next. If by all this I've sparked some interest in you, a new interest perhaps, or deepened an old one in the cardinal virtues and perhaps provoked you to think and read more about them, in fiction as well as fact, that would indeed be a wonderful thing. Thank you all so much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.